You're listening to Radio Reverb 97.2 FM in the Brighton area and RadioReverb.com online. Welcome to the UK's only radio show about HIV and living a healthy life. It's the HIV Hour. On today's show, we feature a rundown of the latest news and talking points about living with HIV from the Brighton area and the world at large. Also information on Brighton's HIV organisations and some other events. Do email us at hivhour@gmail.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter at @HIV_hour and Instagram at @HIVHour. If you miss the show on a Thursday at 7 p.m, then you can listen again at 4 p.m. on Monday and at noon on Tuesday, or indeed catch up with an older show by going to the Listen Again page on RadioReverb.com.
Good evening. How is everyone?
Yeah, very well.
We're good, thank you.
Yeah, we've got a really we've got a long tonight, haven't we? So we're going to be very quick.
Packed show.
We're packed. So I hope everyone's okay and listening in tonight. And yeah, we've got a really busy show. So what have we got on the show today, David?
Yeah, well, you and I, we went and interviewed Jonathan Roberts and Dr. Amanda Clark, Mindy Clark, at the research centre attached to the Lawson unit about injectables, medications, which is fascinating.
It was a really good interview, wasn't it? Yeah, and that's really worth listening to. And also, what we got, we've got a great interview, Tony. You did a scoop for us.
Yeah, so I spoke with Cheddar Gorgeous, who's currently on the RuPaul's Drag Race season, UK season 4, talking about what drove him to do his Silence is Death pink triangle outfit and the pansy outfit. So he's a really good ally for our community. So yeah, it was a really good interview.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. And we want to play the whole as much as we can, so that's why we're doing the shorts thing, aren't we? That's why we sound like we're on some...
Brief intro over there, yeah.
Love it.
Let's get on with the show.
Go.
HIV Hour is the UK's only show for people living with HIV, sharing stories, news and views on living positively with the virus.
Welcome back to the HIV Hour on 97.2 FM and on DAB Plus Radio. We're very pleased to be here with Dr. Mindy Clark, who's a specialist in HIV medicine and sexual health, and is also the lead in research for that department here in Brighton, and also Jonathan Roberts, who's a clinical nurse specialist. Welcome to you both.
Hi. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on the show. It's great to have you on board. And today we're going to talk about using HIV injectables, aren't we?
So please do. Tell us about the ILANA study.
As you know, injectable HIV treatment is new. It just became available from about April this year because it was approved by NICE. So clinics have been sort of trying to get their heads around how we actually deliver it, because it's quite a bit of a change for clinics. Because you end up seeing people more frequently to give the injections, etc. So the ILANA study was set up it's an implementation study. So it was set up to work out how do we, in the NHS, how do we best give these injections? What's best for patients? What's best for staff? How do we, just jiggle things around to make sure we've got enough staff and etc. To be able to give the medicines safely. So the ILANA study has been only for people who have already been approved to have the injectables via the NHS, and it asks them to do some extra questionnaires that they wouldn't normally do, and then it asks them to tell us if they would prefer, in the second 6 months of the sort of year-long study, second 6 months of the injections, would they prefer to have the injections still in the HIV clinic, in the Lawson unit, or would they want to have them in the community by our HIV community team? So they could have them potentially in their own homes if they're happy for that, or potentially in a community clinic where the community team, has a, availability to give, to use a room, etc.
Yeah.
So it's really, working out how we do this, and hopefully it will then give some guidance to other clinics who are, looking to have patients start injectables.
Wow. How's it going at the moment then with the injectables?
It's quite exciting seeing patients who have been really desperate to have something other than oral treatment for some time.
Yeah.
By the time I get to see the patients for the study. You know, patients are ones who know what they're getting themselves into. I mean, you know yourself, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, it's more visits than you'd normally have if you were just on oral treatment. And, you know, the injections, once you're established, are 2 monthly. But you have to come in a bit before that to have the oral lead-in for 4 weeks, so oral tablets, oral version of the injectables, just to make sure you haven't got any side effects from those.
Yeah.
If you don't have any side effects from the oral versions of the injections, then you start the injections. 2 injections for everybody, so it's 2 different medicines, 1 injection in each buttock. You have to have the first 2 a month apart, and then you go to 2 monthly injections. And every time you have an injection, you're also having blood tests to check your viral load and some safety bloods as well.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of big undertaking in some ways, but actually, as one of the patients said to me, well, I don't have to think about my HIV treatment 365 times a year. It's just 6 times a year once I'm established, so, you know, the 6 visits to have the injections. And I hadn't really thought of it like that before till he sort of said it in that way.
That's how you learn, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah.
Me coming to my injection last week was, you know, I was worried about my concern was it was 2 months since I've had my last blood test, so I was undetectable then, but I've had 2 months without taking any oral medication tablets, so that was the concern last week. But you know, I think it's those things are how you learn and move forward anyway, isn't it?
I think when you've been used to taking tablets every day for years and years and years, you know, it feels a bit strange to not be doing that.
Yeah.
And it will take a while to get that confidence that actually it's okay, it's still, your HIV is still being, you know, controlled by this treatment.
Yeah.
So I suppose these extra blood tests actually give reassurance to the patients as well, that, you know, that the treatment is working and that they, you know, that there's nothing amiss, because it, you know, I would feel naked if I didn't have my little dosset box with me wherever I went, so and rattling everywhere, so to not have that rattle everywhere I go.
Yeah.
Be like, oh, something's wrong here. But,
Well, and what we're also trying to get people to do who want to have the injections is sign up to our Emerge app, which is an app you can download onto your phone, and it then means that we can push the results to patients, you know, within a couple of weeks, so that you get your results, so you've got them on the phone. You don't have to wait, you know, you know, until you have your next appointment to know that you were undetectable.
It's amazing, that Emerge app, actually. I think it's a really good thing. So a lot of people don't know about it either, do they? It's kind of it's an amazing...
Yeah. It's not for everyone, but, you know, if people are stable on treatment you know, don't need to see the doctor more than once a year, it's, you know,
there's
fantastic.
Not many people that don't have a smartphone in their pockets that's capable of running the Emerge app, so you can, you know, really be managed and be responsible for your health and appointments.
And I think that will gradually roll out again, because it was a research study initially, and then sort of with the injectables coming along, it's been a really good vehicle to deliver, as Mindy said, those results in a timely fashion. So I think more people will probably sign up to Emerge app as they are seeing their doctors and nurses and are familiar.
So how long has the Alana study been running for?
There's a question. We've been open for a couple of months now, I think it is. We've got quite a tight time period, so we're closing actually in the next few weeks.
Right.
They want to have enrolled everybody, you know, fully enrolled for the study to be able to get the results, you know, in a good time. They are the person who's designed the study, so Chloe Hawking, who is a professor in Barts and the London. Essentially has, you know, really designed it so that they we want 50% of the participants to be women, 50% to be non-white, and over 30% to be more than 50, to really get a good diversity in patients in the study. So typically we don't always have those patient groups in clinical research studies, so they're not well represented. So that's you know, great.
Are you looking for more women?
So we've kind of just about fulfilled all our male participants, but we have still got a couple of places left for female participants who might be eligible. So
So you're getting some good preliminary data. Is it too early to say where people would like to have their injections done?
Well, interestingly, a lot of our patients have been very keen on community. right. and having yeah. the injections done in the community. Mm. But we have a slightly different setup here in Brighton and Hove. We're very lucky to have the community team.
Mm. Yes.
And other sites don't have that community yeah. team. They've got, say, research nurses going out to a community base somewhere as opposed to in people's own homes. So whether that's, you know, yeah, but we'll see. We'll see.
So would it be possible to get it done in like a GP practice or somewhere like the Sussex Beacon? Or
I think certainly yeah. in time.
Yeah.
That's what we'd like to look at.
Really quite
yeah.
exciting. Yeah. Maybe you know, not necessarily yeah. no specialists having to give the injections that maybe yeah. rolling out in GP surgeries. The yeah. Sussex Beacon, we've already been doing mm. some injections there, mm. but that's again early days. Mm.
Yeah.
And not part of the study, yeah. but no. as part yeah. of
and it. And it is early days for injectables as a breakthrough yeah. In yeah. medication, isn't yeah. it? Because obviously we've got injectables that are possibly going to last for more months, aren't there? There's ones that may, am I correct in thinking that there might be some injections that don't need a nurse to administer them?
I was going to say that. Yeah.
So, right. Obviously the ideal yeah. would be an injection that has a longer time period mm. between injections, say yeah. 6 months would be amazing. Something that potentially a patient could give themselves or their partner or friend, mm. you know, yeah. just under the skin, for mm. example. Mm. That's, you know,
long term.
There's things in the pipeline for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even for this current injection, even thinking about places, other sites as opposed to the buttocks that you can give it, so in mm. the thigh, you know, things like this are certainly being looked at. Yeah.
To be honest, I had my last injection. It's been in my posterior. I like that word, posterior. but this time I went into the thigh. And it's much better. So for me, it works better in the thigh. Yeah. So
Josh's bottom needs a break.
Anyway, moving on.
but that, you know, again, as Mindy's saying, these, you know, some of these sites that we're giving injectables, the mm. nurses aren't being trained in university to mm. give it at certain sites, but now they are. So I think from that point yeah. of view, there'll be a lot of variability in where we can give it, depending on the actual amount of the fluid that you're injecting, which at the moment is 3 mils. There are certain sites you mm. have to give it in, whereas, you know, if it's subcutaneous, again, that would be a different amount of fluid that you could give subcutaneously. So it does, you know, all depend on lots of different sort of variables, doesn't it?
Yeah.
At the moment, they're
yeah.
looking into that. So
obviously, it needs to be in a place in the body where it's going to stay and last for the desired
Absolutely.
Amount of time, isn't
yeah.
it?
So, yeah.
I'm sorry, how does it work? Because before I went on to that, I was thinking, how does the time last?
Slow release.
Slow release. How does it actually work?
So it's two different drugs. Cabotegravir, which is an integrase inhibitor,
yeah.
and wilpivirine, which is a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase, NNRTI. So they work in two different ways on the HIV life cycle, but they've been formulated so they're long-acting. So they're given into the, so at the moment, into the buttock muscle, so into the deep into the muscle, and they act as a sort of reservoir for slowly giving out some of the drug to the rest of the body.
Yeah,
important to know that because they're there, they can stay in the body for a long time. So although you have to have an injection every 2 months, we know that if you didn't have the injections, they can stay in the body for one of the drugs is a year and the other drug can be even longer at very low levels. Not levels enough to actually work, but yeah. levels enough that you could get resistance if mm. you don't take other treatment. You know, if you decide that you needed to stop the injectables, for example. So you just need to, you know, people need to be aware of that.
Yeah.
You know, stopping suddenly is something that we'd ever recommend without starting on a replacement oral treatment.
Yeah. And you can go, if it doesn't work, you can go back onto other treatments. Is that right?
So in the studies yeah. that were done that sort of licensed, you know, they label these to be available to us, there were some patients who, for whom the treatment failed. And that's why we're being extra cautious, certainly in the UK, and checking people's viral load at every time that they come in and have a visit.
Yeah.
For some people, there were some clear risk factors of why the treatment failed. And it seems to be if you have a certain type of HIV, a certain subtype, A1, A6 it is called, with a high body mass index of more than 30, those two in combination really put your risk of treatment failure up.
Wow.
or if you've previously failed treatment or have got some underlying resistance to those classes of drugs, the NNRTIs or the integrase inhibitors, that absolutely puts your risk up of treatment failure. But there were a few cases of people whose treatment failed and didn't have a clear risk factor. So there's still some information that we haven't got, that we don't clearly understand why, you know, a small amount of patients may still fail treatment. Wow. Yeah. So that's why we're being very cautious as to who we kind of approve to start on treatment, yeah. There's no concerns that there could be any underlying resistance.
And there's a really stringent process of that. So they go to a multidisciplinary team where it's discussed and resistance tests are talked about so that we know what medication people are resistant to, so they would not necessarily be offered the option of injectables should they have resistance to these two classes that Mindy talked about.
Yeah. So I heard someone saying that they forget to take their medication quite a lot. And they become detectable, so people like that, it's like, well, that would be good for somebody, but maybe...
So at the moment, the injectable drugs are licensed for people who have been undetectable for, you know, a decent time period, basically 3 months or 6 months. So they're not currently licensed for people who've got detectable viral load. Yeah. There have been some cases where people have got the injectable treatment as what we call expanded access. So, you know, sort of exceptional cases that really this is their only chance of becoming undetectable is by having an injection. So that's a different process. Wow. So again, it's a bit early days for our experience of that, but we've certainly had to go through that process for some patients.
Are there others? Well, is it Brighton and London that are just doing it? Is it across the UK?
No, it's rolled out throughout the UK.
So every clinic is. Wow. Meant to be able to provide it. Obviously, it is a resource, you know, it is limited by resources and staff that can do it. And I think that's been the real barrier to particularly maybe some of the smaller clinics to be able to roll it out.
And then, I know in Scotland they were a bit ahead of the game, so they started rolling out injectables a lot earlier, but then NICE guidance came in. And then we were told within England to try and roll it out from the beginning of April. So that's when we sort of, the alarmist study sort of came into being around August. And then we also, like yourself, Josh, managed to offer people that weren't necessarily, not suitable for the Ilana, but that weren't sort of targeted people that, as Mindy said, had certain sort of, you know, whether their ethnic background or their sex or age, you know, might indicate that this is the people that we were targeting for that particular study. But then we've offered it to other people outside of that.
Yeah, so we've got people who are on the Ilana study on it, and then other people who are on it as just routine NHS care.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's what everyone, you know, once we're full up with Ilana, which we nearly are, then people can still get it through the NHS.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just need to sort of talk to their healthcare professional at their next visit, you know, talk about the pros and cons, see if they're potentially eligible, then it will go through a sort of approval process, a sort of team meeting where we approve and look at everything with a fine toothpick, and then they'll get a call, then they join the waiting list.
What have you two learned then about doing this one? Because it's a new...
What have we kind of learned from the process of rolling it out?
Yeah, doing that because...
I think, you know, again, the feedback from patients like yourself is that, you know, there's that initial sort of anxiety thinking, oh my God, I'm meant to be taking my medication and I'm not taking it. And then the slight anxiety of, okay, will my viral load still be undetectable when I see my nurse or doctor in a couple of months' time? So those are the big sort of things. But also how liberating it's been for some people as well, just thinking, I can go on holiday, I don't need to take my tablets with me. If I'm working up in London and suddenly the train strikes are, you know, off and I, you know, I run out of medication or something like that. Those kind of scenarios.
And also you can travel to some countries that are, you know, restrictive in terms of travelling with antiretrovirals. Yeah, and that's true, been, you know, for some people, particularly if it's related to work or family, etc., then, that's massively important.
But it breaks down stigma as well, doesn't it? So if people are aware that this is a treatment available, it might encourage people to get tested, it might encourage people to think differently about their own HIV journey. It's a game changer, just similar, I suppose, to combination therapy in a way.
I think you're right. So for some people, taking a tablet every day reminds them every day that they're living with HIV, and you know, that can, for some people, you know, be a problem.
A challenge.
And this can really help in that
That's definitely been a reason why people put themselves forward, is the stigma related with tablets, you know, taking them and having to disclose maybe your status when you're out and about or doing something and not wanting to sort of carry on like that and liberating and having injections and you don't need to disclose
think
that.
About that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's also sort of quite stringent guidelines about the storage of it because the real pivoting part of the injectables needs to be stored in a refrigerated area and also have those controls of the pharmacy, you know, so and then be taken out and then after two hours, you know, you, you can either put it in within those 2 hours, but if it's longer than that, then you might have to discard it. So we are, you know, we're quite sort of regimented in when people have got appointments, we sort of, as you know, just phone up, just check people are coming in because once that medication's out for too long a period, it has to be disposed and it is.
So it's good to know, because I mean, the listeners will obviously recall what happened during some of the COVID vaccines. They know they had to be kept in very, very cold storage and, you know, to avoid wastage and,
exactly the same, you're right. Yeah.
Keep your appointments.
Yes. So if anyone wants to, see, for the other study, there's a bit of time left, is it?
So what are we now? We're, so we've probably got about 3 weeks to potentially enrol any more women.
So if, anyone, so if anyone wants is listening tonight and they want to, they're interested.
So ideally, they need to speak to their normal healthcare professional.
Yes, yes,
that would be the ideal. You know, if there's some problems and they need some facilitation, they, you know, they can call our, you know, and they're a patient in you know, in Brighton, in the Lawson unit, they can call our research unit. I hope the nurses don't tell me off. And we can see if we can facilitate that a bit more, seeing as the timelines are a bit tight. But for other patients who, if they don't fit that category, then we, what we are suggesting to everyone is they wait until they've got their next healthcare appointment to discuss that. No drug is without its side effects, right? So I think it's important, people to be aware. So the commonest side effect for everyone is an injection site reaction, which, as you can imagine, everyone knows from COVID jabs is, you know, sort of, you know, pain, redness, soreness around that area where the injection was. And most people in all of the studies got some kind of injection site reaction, typically lasts just a few days, typically is mild, but for some people it lasts a bit longer. Very rarely do people stop because of the pain of that or the discomfort of that. In the studies, you know, like one or two patients out of, you know, hundreds stopped because of it. So it's sort of tolerated, kind of think of it as sort of good pain, doing good pain And then just the side effects of, you know, of the drugs, you know, things like headache, feeling a bit nauseous, are probably the most commonest ones. People always worry about weight gain, and we know that particularly the integrase class of drugs can be associated a bit more with weight gain. So on average, it's been about 1.5 kilos. But then on average, about people put on about a kilo a year, apparently. So, you know, it's...
And do these side effects sort of show up during the oral phase beforehand? Or do you some surprise side effects after you...
Obviously, no injection site reactions in the oral phase, but those other side effects, that's the whole point of the oral lead-in, so that if you get, you know, bad headaches or really bad nausea or any other, you know, problems, that actually we don't have to then proceed to the injection. You can switch back to your old medicines, or we might go, oh, let's just give it an extra couple of weeks, let's see if it settles down on the same medicines, because often things do settle down after a few weeks. So it just means that you're not then... You don't, you know, have the injection inside you, and then go, oh, I've got a side effect.
You can't get it out quickly.
Yeah, you can't suck it out. We've only had one person that's discontinued in the oral lead-in phase. Everyone else at the moment is doing really well. So you know that's it. I think it's really beneficial to have that oral lead-in phase. Because I think, you know, you can then pick up those side effects quite quickly, because they can be not just physical; they can also cause sort of psychological problems as well, so it is really important to have that.
Yeah, and it might give people more confidence that actually it's okay, I feel okay on the oral treatment, so yeah, I'm fine to proceed to the injectables.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on. That's really, really, really amazing. It's great to know. Yeah, it's just good to get it out there, isn't it?
Yeah, and because it is very exciting. For some, it's just game changing. Yeah, I mean, it really is for some people, and that's. It's very exciting seeing people who are just so happy to be starting it. It makes us happy too.
And thanks again. I'll thank you personally because you look look after me and coming in quite a lot of good here actually. that's just me.
That's good to hear.
Yes.
Yeah.
Radio Reverb.
Radio Reverb.
Hi there, welcome back to the HIV Hour. I'm Tony, one of the presenters, and I'm here with the gorgeous and simply stunning Dr. Cheddar Gorgeous from RuPaul's Drag Race Season 4 in the UK. How are you doing today?
Good, darling. Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. I hope that I do what it says on the tin, and I am indeed gorgeous, as you suggest.
Well, I hope so, darling. I mean, from what we see, I mean, I've been following you for a long time, and you've got such a...
I wondered who that was.
Yeah, it's me. It's me, you know, the one you put the lawyer on to.
I have that. Do you know when people say, I've been following you for a long time, I immediately go to a dark place with it. I'm really sorry that I went there, but like, it's funny, isn't it, the terminology we have around social media. I've been following you. Have you? Don't do that.
Yes, don't do that. Are you looking in my windows now, you dirty thing? Amazing. No, you're such a visual artist. Whether you're as you are out of drag or in drag, you're such a, I don't know, you're just like an eye orgasm. You just like, for example, when you had the makeup challenge, it was like gold and silver. And it's visually appealing. So no matter what, like, for example, this week's with you, the pansy one, that was amazing. And what we want to talk about today is your pink triangle moment, because... For me, as a positive person, I've been positive since 1998. I was attacked while I was working overseas. And to have that kind of visibility on just in the general media, I mean, I know Drag Race is getting there. I mean, I watch every single franchise or whatever. I'm a bit of a Drag Race fiend. But to have that kind of visibility on... you know, the main stage or anywhere in the general media is so heartening for me, because for so many years it was so stigmatized. It still is. But to see it visibly on the BBC, it was like, wow, okay, it was a real moment. So what made you do that and why?
So I think there's a point there where you're talking about the idea of being an eye orgasm and being a spectacle. I think as a drag queen, you've got to sometimes let the material do the work for you. Mm-hmm. And you brought up like the gold and the silver. And I think whether you're talking about the material in terms of the substances you use or the material in the terms of the themes that you're exploring, you have to have things that have weight.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? And it makes better drag when things have weight. Mm. And so for me, I always find the drag easier if it's something that is meaningful to me. And it's a story that actually matters. And I think sometimes we like to think of drag solely in terms of entertainment. Mm. And don't get me wrong, drag is great entertainment. Yeah. It's fun. It makes us laugh. It's wonderful. I don't tend to do that. But... many other drag queens are very funny. But for me, I just really love to think that drag is something that can tell other stories beyond entertainment and still be entertaining and still be visually appealing. So for me, bringing up the pink triangle, the pink triangle is a symbol that I've just always resonated with. I remember being told the story many, many years ago. About where the pink triangle comes from, and then obviously subsequently learning about how it was reappropriated and used in the ACT UP movement. And I think there is something there about how drag's power is in its use of symbols and spectacle and standing out. And that's always kind of what, for me, has made drag quite special and distinct from other art forms. It's probably, it's rooted in communities that had a need to be visible.
Absolutely.
And that's very much in the message. We may say silence equals death, but also invisibility also equals death. So drag, if you think of it, is a way of making aspects of ourselves, aspects of our experience, stories that we want to tell, making them the only thing that people see when you walk in the room, and pushing those forward, those stories forward. But more than that, allowing people to relate to them, because we are literally the stories and we have a person-like qualities and people like to relate to people. So it's just a way of making those things that can seem quite abstract and sometimes quite difficult to deal with, it can ground them in the lived experience of a person that you're watching and connecting with on screen.
100%. And I
love that.
And I think the way you've done it, and I think we've had we have had a few, I say we, the royal we, but there has been a few people that have represented us, you know, in Drag Race and in the media. I think it's really good that it wasn't, you know, people would actually, although you explained it, I think, to Dakota, and you were talking and you were explaining where it came from with the Holocaust and then when it went through with the ACT UP movement and, you know, in the 80s and 90s. And I think it was really good to have that storytelling brought forward and to be told to another generation, because I think, I mean, I'm nearly 50. I know, I don't look it, but I'm nearly 50.
Don't.
Oh, thanks, babe.
You
thanks,
don't, babe. Girl.
It's all the bulldog clips. But I think it's really good that we've had now another generation of people that will watch this and for future generations, and that will be brought forward, because I think it's so important, the sentiment, but also everything that goes behind that sentiment. And I think the way you described it and the way you, you know, talked about it, it wasn't just the ACT UP movement, you brought in the Holocaust. And I think that is so important because, you know, we, you know, yeah, so important.
I was shocked that the show, shocked is the right word. I was pleasantly surprised that the show let me go there.
Yeah.
And actually, not only did it let me go there during when we were filming, it really brought that forward. And not just in a kind of a tokenistic way, it let me go deep with it. Yeah. And I think I was surprised at the amount of space that it was given, and really, really happy with the amount of space that it was given, because I think it is a complex issue. And whilst I am not a positive person, which I talked about on the show, and I've been on prep for many years now. I've had lots of positive friends, positive lovers. There have been many positive people who've played an incredible role in my life, and even in shaping my drag. But I think also it's so important to acknowledge the centrality of HIV to all, particularly queer men's lives, and to the broader idea of homophobia in our society and the broader of attachment of shame to my sex and my desire to a sense of who I am. And I think in finding that unity between us and understanding how both positive and non-positive people alike, we share in that in very different ways and with very different impacts, you know what I mean, without taking away from absolutely the difficult journey that positive people have around stigma and still have about stigma today, unfortunately. But I think there's also something in really acknowledging that we are interconnected and we need to start caring for one another and looking after one another and loving one another and not inflicting shame on one another, because that's what was done to us, all of us.
I think, yeah, definitely. I think you've probably hit the nail on the head. It's, you know, we are all interconnected with love, and the fact that, you know, me as a positive person, I still want to get that love. I still want to, you know, have the rude times, the adult times. But, you know, so often, you know, we all do, dear, we all do. But you know, it's, I think people have, and I think this is the stigma coming out as well, that, you know, oh, why do you want to have sex? You're positive. And it's like, because, you know, I've got a pulse, you know, it's not like I'm, but yeah, unity. And I think, go on.
Sorry, you carry on.
No, you
go. No, I was going to say, I think gay men's journeys in search of love and positive men's journeys in search of love are really, I feel like there's a lot of tragedy for us. There's a lot of pleasure. There's a lot of joy that people have had to claim and fight for in sex and in physical intimacy and in love outside of sex and physical intimacy. But there's a lot of peculiar unpacking that we're all still doing around that drive for love.
Absolutely.
I'm currently working on a piece of research with, I'm an ambassador for two organizations. One is the George House Trust, who you will, I'm sure, know, support men living with HIV. Mm-hmm. And, you know, are involved in the mission in ensuring that HIV holds nobody back. That's our tagline. Yeah. And the other organization I'm an ambassador for is Survivors Manchester.
Okay.
Who are an organization that works with male survivors of childhood sexual abuse and rape. And I'm currently working on a project about the interconnectedness of HIV and chemsex and consent. So, and thinking around the impact of stigma, not for all, but for some people in our community.
Absolutely.
The impacts of stigma, the impacts of shame, the kinds of paths that it can lead down sometimes, and indeed the kind of ways that we can start to create love and care and support for those guys, you know. Yeah. Rather ineloquently said then, but I think I'm just trying to recognise that we're all still unpacking a lot of stuff from that time period where homosexuality was inextricably bound to contagion and death.
Absolutely.
And we can't deny the intergenerational impact of that. And there's obviously there's the direct impact of those men who died. There is the other impact of the men who survived and the people who still live with stigma today.
Yep.
And then there is the broader, more diluted impact that we all feel in relation to that dynamic.
Absolutely.
Get a bit deep.
No, it's what we all need. I think also it's good that we have these deep discussions because there is so much brought forward. I came out as 15 and there is so much stuff that we get packed away and put in a box and like the key gets locked away and then, you know, that unpacks later on when you don't want it to. But definitely, and I think the whole chemsex with guys, you know, wanting to find love and whatever, I don't know if that's the right way of putting it, but you know, there is a lot of assimilation.
I thought it was part of my love ecology.
Your love ecology. I love
part of
that.
A love ecology.
Definitely. But I think there is a lot of, I don't know. I think there is a preconceived idea that people who, or guys or girls who are HIV positive, you know, do the chem sex. They go to, you know, sex parties and do whatever and are very irresponsible. You know, that's further from the truth, you know. That's not really what happens, I don't think, anyway, in my world, anyway. But
well, the truth is, there are many positive people, there are many gay people who have absolutely no interest in that world whatsoever.
I know.
And there are many people actually who participate in and make use of drugs during sex, and for whom it never becomes an issue for them. It never becomes a problem. Totally. I think the thing is, we need to have these difficult conversations. Yeah. Where they're needed to be had, because if you don't have these difficult conversations within your community, you know what? Somebody outside the community is going to have them for you.
Exactly.
And they're going to throw all of their heap load of assumptions, all of the things you're talking about people being irresponsible, about people being destructive amongst one another, and they're going to heap all that on you. So unless we figure this out and actually create our own communities of care
Absolutely.
That do think about those things and look after those people who need to be looked after, And that's absolutely, there are absolutely people out there who are heterosexual, who are engaged in all sorts of things, who maybe also need a little bit of care and need a little bit of love as well.
Yeah, totally.
But it's going to be very, it's a lot easier for people to, if you like, section off us and make us the ones who are doing something wrong as an entire community. So I think that's where having a difficult conversation is necessary. You want to have it before the people who really don't like you have it.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. And I think what I was going to say then was, I think it's really important to have the conversation about PrEP for those who aren't positive. And I think that was really good that you discussed that in the packet, or whatever they call it, on the show. You were saying, you know, I'm on PrEP. And I think that's, you know, because one of my friends who's straight, and she was like, so what's this PrEP then? And I was like, okay, so you pre-exposure prophylaxis, you take it before you have unprotected sex, it'll stop you catching HIV. And she was like, you can get that. And I'm like, and it's free. So, you know, the only thing you've got to do is, you know. And she was like, oh my God. So, you know, I think it's a really important thing. You know, people have got to take responsibility for their own sexual health. And I think it hasn't been that for so long.
There was an interesting, because I try to read a lot of social media. I don't engage with some social media because I think it's really friggin' toxic.
Oh, totally.
But I do try to kind of get a grasp of what people make of stuff. And I'll come back to the kind of response that the thing I put out on the show had, because there was something very specific that really did resonate with me. But one of the things when I talked about PrEP was that actually there were a couple of people who had an issue with the fact we didn't talk about condom use. And I respect where they're coming from. Mm. I absolutely respect where they're coming from. But you see, the thing is, people know what a condom is. Generally, it's quite a well-known thing now. People know what a condom is.
It's been out a few years.
People don't know what PrEP is.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, people don't know what PrEP is. And so I would always say, sure, condoms are amazing things, wonderful. PrEP does not protect you against a whole load of other STI nasties out there.
Mm.
But we are talking about PrEP and we are talking about HIV.
Absolutely.
And for me, PrEP fundamentally changed my relationship to sex. PrEP made me realize how sex had been bound with death for me for my entire sex life, from when I first started having sex when I was, oh God, how old was it, like 17 or something like that. I don't know whether that's a late bloomer or an early bloomer these days, who knows. But for me, I didn't realize how sex was only risk until I started PrEP, because it opened up this door. And I noticed it on, like, I used to be a prolific Grindr user, to the extent where it was a bit of a problem for me at points. But I remember talking to people when PrEP came out.
Yeah.
And the change that happened around the idea of condomless sex, because condomless sex went from something which was associated intrinsically with risk taking.
Oh, 100%.
Intrinsically with a form of self-destruction. And if you would have the kink almost from condomless sex was that kind of idea that it was risque. And I remember when PrEP came on the scene, all of a sudden condomless sex became about asking the question, are you on PrEP? And absolutely, it changed the story behind that kink. The story for barebacking then became, are you looking after yourself and each other?
Exactly.
Not, are you willing to take a risk? And I think that fundamental shift in terms of desire allowed so many people, both positive and people who weren't positive, so both people on PrEP and also equally, we can talk about U=U, had this same impact.
Totally.
I'm sure you share that as a positive person.
Absolutely.
But it changed that relationship, because no longer did having that level of intimacy and closeness have to mean risk.
Risk, or, yeah.
You look back to that 80s and 90s, right, and you look back at those gravestones falling from the sky. Everybody knew HIV was a death sentence, or AIDS, as it was, like on those gigantic gravestones. It was a death sentence. Where are our fluffy clouds dropping from the sky that say U equals U, that say PrEP prevents HIV transmission by so-and-so percent? Where are these adverts? Where are these campaigns? You know, and I think that's what's sad. And that's what's so lovely about what Drag Race did recently, because it's this renewal. It's this renewal of going, actually, this is a message that now needs to get out there.
Yeah.
Guys, the situation has changed. The big enemy now is stigma.
Yeah.
The big enemy is ensuring that we deal with this in an adult way. The big enemy is access to PrEP. Like, let's be clear.
Yeah. And I know I was at the UK government trying to reduce HIV transmission down to zero. I can't remember what the year is, but it's not that far off. But we're not that far off. And I think the more people that get on PrEP, the more people that really seriously look after their own sexual health and their own health in general.
Well, I think everybody needs hand with visibility, and that's what drag can do, right? Like, I've done drag about climate change. I've done drag about all sorts of issues. Yeah. I would say that HIV is much closer to my heart, just because I'm enmeshed within a community that it's such a huge issue for.
Totally.
And it has played such an important part of my life, and also my role as ambassador for George House Trust.
Exactly.
I will say that, returning back to that social media stuff, the thing that was probably, and sorry, I do get a little bit emotional with that, but the thing that was the most affirming about that episode was the amount of people who were positive who got in touch with me. And just to say that they loved it, just to say that it resonated with them, that's a gift, because it makes me feel like this thing that can be quite silly, drag can be quite silly, it can be quite frivolous, I have a lot of fun doing it, but it makes me feel like it has a purpose and a meaning. And that's a real to be given that, that's a real beautiful gift. So I don't say that lightly. Every single message, because I made an effort on that week just to make sure, because lots of messages get lost when you've got a big following online. But I made an effort just to kind of try and read. And I received so much stuff from positive guys. And that was really lovely, really beautiful. And so in many ways, like, you need more advocates. I would say that the thing that I got in return in terms of feeling like I had a purpose and affirmation for what I do in my art, like, oh, like, you have no idea how much I needed that.
Yeah, I can just only imagine. You know, you put your, I can tell you, with your artwork and with your visual artistry, you do so much to make everything matter. And I mean, obviously we've got the rest of the season to go, but, and it will be amazing.
Radio Reverb.
97.2.
Radio Reverb.
So I think so much of the time people want to see drag only as that thing that's on the stage, particularly if you're looking from outside of the community. But of course, a lot of what drag queens do happens when we come off stage. It happens in our engagement on social media. It happens in our conversations with people at the bar. Mm-hmm. It happens with our attendance at charity events, with our attendance at protests. It's all of that stuff that's in between that's often neglected about drag. The social dimension of drag is often removed, and even when people trace the histories of drag, they're really interested in the theatrical traditions and less interested in the social significance of drag. And I think that's really, really interesting, because there's in a way a removal of some of what drag's real power is from that, both in terms of the kind of support it can offer people, the way it brings communities together, the way it functions as a sort of social glue, but also in the way that it actually uses spectacle to amplify important messages, which is exactly what we're talking about, right?
Totally.
And that happens at the level of the bar, providing support and giving conversations, being mother, like you were talking about in Pose, but also all the way through to doing charity gigs. And the amount of work that queens give doing fundraising and things like that particularly like, you know, the village queens, you know, the queens who are working in their local scene all of the time, they're the real drag heroes.
Yeah.
They're the real people who are doing the real drag. All the stuff at the top is lovely and great, and it's wonderful to see that queer amplification right up there on national television, on the BBC. All of that stuff is great, but if they only see us as entertainers, they're kind of missing the point.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, totally. Because like you said, we've got some amazing queens in Brighton. I live just outside Brighton. And so are the queens that are in Brighton that you never see, they go up to London and they do sort of gigs around the UK, but you know, you go in and see them and they are like literally the glue for the community. They really are.
Yeah.
I think also like the drag queens are the glue, but also you get the, not the local ones, that's locals that stay in the bar like 24/7, but you know, the older queens that probably get a bit overlooked by everybody, they are also the glue, and they're the bits that hold the community together. As I said, you know, this thing I run in Worthing and West Sussex, you know, we've got such a varied amount and age range from people like 20s all the way up to, I think our oldest one's nearly 80, bless him. And they are literally like they're like matriarchs, and it's so lovely to see them because we do like a Christmas do and stuff, and it's so brilliant because you get the older ones and you have like a, not a group rounder, but they have their little pods of friends, and you can just tell they're sort of the mothers of that little group. It's really lovely.
Everyone needs mothers.
We do. Absolutely. Yeah. Bless, my drag mother didn't know what she was doing when she put me in drag. Wow. It wasn't a look. I needed it a few times. Feet couldn't cope. So what are your plans going forward past the old Drag Race UK? What are your plans going forward for the next season?
I don't know what I'm allowed to speak about. I don't know where. Because, of course, nobody knows what's going to happen yet, do we? We've still got 2 more weeks to go. Could happen. We'll just have to wait and see.
We're all chomping, dear. Chomping at the bit.
Anything could happen. She could send us all home. What could happen? She's been so kind to us throughout the season so far. Maybe she'll just get so frustrated with us at the end, she'll send us all away, like naughty schoolgirls.
Is Ru as scary as some of the queens have come out? I mean, like, you know, I follow quite a few drag queens, but is she as statuesque as a man and then as a woman? Which is more powerful to you?
I found Ru's presence equally powerful. Doesn't matter to me what Ru was wearing. I thought that they were an intelligent, insightful, and incredibly interesting person.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have used the word intimidating at all. I think sometimes that's something that people bring to the table.
Yeah.
Because RuPaul obviously has such a lot of reverence that goes for RuPaul. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And that's not saying that I don't have that reverence. Like, I thought that they were really, really interesting.
I like
and
that.
And quite an inspiring presence.
Yeah.
Definitely. Clearly somebody who knows themselves and is working.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And I mean, I didn't mean intimidating as in, oh my God, scary, but, you know, I think shying away behind the cushion. But sometimes, you know, I can't remember what it was the last season where she shouted at Joe Black, I think it was. She doesn't want,
maybe we just had her on good days, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I never got any of that energy.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I can imagine.
I don't need any secrets or behind the things, but what is your plan for the next 6 months? Are you going to just do your tour, or have you got any tours coming up to plug or anything?
Yeah, obviously there's the Voss tour that's coming up in April.
Yeah.
Tickets now available from VossEvents.com.
Excellent.
Check it out. Oh my God.
Check it out. Get the tickets booked.
Somebody give that girl some branding deals.
Yes.
I am I am working a lot, actually. Very, very, very happy and very excited. I've got a lot of gigs coming up between now and Christmas. I'm going to be doing, I've got some of the little side projects that I'm working on. And I'm working on a lot of different things. And I think it's going to be which stuff comes to fruition in the next 6 months.
Yeah.
It's been an unplugging for me. Which is a lovely expression to use. It's been a declogging. And there's been a lot of different things that have been in my mind to want to do for a long time, and it's a good opportunity to start working on those.
That's great.
So it's going to be a couple of years of hard work, I think, from this point, because the show is a great opportunity to try and get done some of the stuff that you wanted to get done and have a new audience that's interested in that.
Yeah, getting those passion projects done. Yeah, getting those passion projects done and getting some with George House and stuff like that. Maybe getting some more stuff for that done and, you know, working through those things. I love it.
What would you like to see me do? And I'll do it. I'll add it to the list.
Oh my gosh. Come down for my Christmas do. No,
go on. No. Here you are, controlling my destiny.
Oh, I'm controlling. Right, okay. So this is almost like an Instagram. It'd be really good to see you do a character challenge, or I don't know, you know, like when you get, God, you put me on the spot now. You know, like you get a museum, you know, the Museum of Fine Art and stuff. It'd be great to have that for Drag Race, or even you just individually, and just have some of the things, the pieces that meant so much to you, and have that actually displayed, and then have the story behind it, and have maybe a visual of you explaining why that was meant, why that was so important for you.
Yeah, I've exhibited looks before in museums and galleries, and I'd love to do some of that with some of the looks from the show, because all of them have a story, both in terms of the making of them, because it's my friends and me that were making a lot of stuff, and the kind of story that underpinned them, and the kind of thing that I was wanting to explore in them. So they all definitely have a story. And I've done quite a bit of work in museums and galleries using drag as a kind of form of intervention. But you know what I would love to do? I'm going to put, you know, because what people say now is they say, put it out into the universe.
Put it out.
Put it out into the universe and it'll happen. So what I want to do in the next year is I'd love a role in the MCU. I'm just putting it out there. If there are any people looking for a charismatic, interdimensional being
deities
to appear in the MCU, I am available. And I can do many different voices. And I will make that work. And I will find space in my diary for it. And if the MCU isn't available, I will accept Star Wars.
I just wanted to thank you, as a person who is positive, that to make us matter, to give us a voice, and I'm not going to cry, but to give us...
I did.
I know, bless you. Just to give us a voice, make us visible, because I feel visible sometimes as a positive person, you know. Just gave us a voice, and I'm really touched that you, firstly, you said yes for the interview. Thank you. I'm just thankful that you put us out there and you continue to do what you do.
Let's get people talking.
Yeah.
Let's get people talking. And that's what things like this are great for. Let's keep people talking, because that's what's going to solve this stuff. That's what's going to iron out all of this stuff. And I mean it like in the, like, because it's really, I understand the distinction that you're making, but for me, like, positive people are my, you know, they're my family, like they're my lovers, they're my brothers, they are.
They're your chosen family.
They're absolutely, and we're integrated. We're one. Yeah. Family. And so for me to not want to fight for the thing that they need fighting for,
yeah,
like that's abandoning your family.
Yeah.
So yeah, Thank you for having me.
But that's so important for us to have people that are there and visible. Even though you're not positive, that doesn't mean anything. It means that you've given us a voice and you've made sure that we are heard. And we do need more people like that on our side. And it shouldn't be that way. We should have everyone on our side or everyone that wants to be on our side. But, you know, honestly, I'm really touched that you allowed us to have this interview. You've connected and you did that on Drag Race. And obviously, the HIV Hour, obviously Team Cheddar, obviously. We're putting the hashtag out, Team Cheddar. We're Team Cheddar.
Another
few votes. Some more votes. Come on, Rue. You can do it, babe. Thank you so much.
HIV Hour, positively helping to change hearts and minds.
Thank you.
Yes. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Fantastic interviews. We're just going to finish on a bit of news in Brighton. You may have heard on the 27th of November to commemorate World AIDS Day, the HIV History Club, at the Brighton Museum, they're going to have a talk from 3 till 5, and I'm going to be one of the guest speakers. The tickets are £3 and it's going to be a while worth afternoon, so you can go on the website and get one of the tickets for £3, and it just commemorates World AIDS Day this year. And
it's great stuff, isn't it? No, it's great, isn't it? Yeah, no, it's great. And it's because World AIDS Day is coming up. We've got like one, we've got three shows coming up, so we've got lots to pack in, haven't we? Mm-hmm. But also, I was going to say that Cheddar Gorgeous, it's a longer interview, so that's going to be on the full, that's going to be on the podcast.
Yes.
So we've edited it. So please do check that out. And yeah, that was like a real whirlwind of a show.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. But we've got some exciting things coming up to the run-up to World AIDS Day. So we've got some really, you know, I say Tony's done a great one, which we've played, and you guys have. And we've got some great interviews coming up just to commemorate this special, of World AIDS Day, poignant every year. But yes, got some exciting things coming up.
So next week I've got, I'm interviewing Gary Pardister as well on for World AIDS Day as well, and Philip Ragg, just to go over what we're going to... What's going to happen on World AIDS Day around the town? So also this week, weekend is my I've got a club night coming up called Project House, which is in Brighton. It's going to be at St James Tavern on Saturday night. Starts at 8 p.m. It's going to be house music across the board. So if you want to come down, please do join me and Steve, who's organised it. And that's at St James Tavern on St James Street in Brighton. And that's Project House. Fabulous. Mm. Have a great week, and speak to you.
You all too.
See you next week. Cheerio. See you next week. Cheerio. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
HIVR is the UK's only show for people living with HIV, sharing stories, news, and views on living positively with the virus.